what kind of persuade my vote was just to think of our kids, because I have a like 8-year-old daughter. We've got to think of her future.
The village of Shishmaref votes to relocate. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, August 18th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, expanding the Fire Island Wind Project.
With the benefits of the wind and the reasonable cost that Siri is providing us, it makes economic sense to take a real good hard look at this.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The University of Alaska Southeast School of Management offers online college degrees in business, human resources, management, and accounting, all created with the flexibility and convenience of e-learning. More at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
One precinct has not yet recorded its Tuesday primary ballots with the State Division of Elections. That's McCoryuk in District 38. The community sits on Nunavak Island off the coast of the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. Angelique Horton with the division says the McCoryuk voting machine malfunctioned when the election workers tried to close it out on Tuesday. She says the memory card from the machine is being flown from the island to the region's election district office in Nome and should arrive today. Zach Fansler remains in the lead and presumed winner over incumbent Bob Herron for the House District 38 Democratic primary. With 30 of 31 precincts counted, Fansler has received 56.7% or 1,099 votes compared to 43.3% or 839 votes for Herron. Fansler says he will not do any interviews until all precincts are recorded. The community of Shishmaref will relocate to one of two potential sites. Shishmaref residents held a vote on Tuesday. The Associated Press reports unofficial results were 89 in favor of relocating and 78 in favor of staying in place and protecting. Two potential relocation sites have been surveyed and selected in a collaborative effort between the Army Corps of Engineers and Shishmaref community members. Old Pond and West Tin Creek are both across the lagoon from Shishmaref. Old Pond is further inland than West Tin Creek. Minnie Olana, one of approximately 650 residents in Shishmaref and the chairperson for the elections judges, says there are many factors to consider when voting for relocation, including impending storms.
I think that it might be better to leave, you know, at least some of us think that we're going to have a real bad one pretty soon.
She also has concerns for future generations.
What kind of persuade my vote was just to think of our kids, because I have a like 8-year-old daughter, and I just thought of how, you know, she'd be inherit my house, so I've got to think of her future.
Another challenge that is a concern for some residents is how they will receive gas and oil shipments at either of the two relocation sites. According to Army Corps surveys, the land at West Tin Creek is shallow and is not deep enough for a barge or tanker to port, while Old Pond would require a connecting road from Nome to be built in order for fuel shipments to reach them. It's estimated that relocation will cost $180 million. Mayor Howard Weawana says protecting in place would have been the cheaper option.
From all the studies and the reports that the departments that we work with, the state and the federal government, they're saying that it would be, how shall I put it, a whole lot cheaper to stay and protect instead of moving the whole community.
Within the next year, a follow-up vote will take place in Shishmaref to determine which of the two sites the community will relocate to. The unofficial counts do not include absentee or special needs ballots. After years of talks and setbacks, there's momentum to expand the Fire Island Wind Project. The first turbine started spinning on the island near Anchorage 4 years ago, but a planned expansion has stalled ever since. Elizabeth Harbaugh from Alaska's Energy Desk has more.
SERI wants to double the number of wind turbines on Fire Island from 11 to 22, but convincing power companies to pay for its electricity has been hard. Siri says now it's nearing a deal with Golden Valley Electric in Fairbanks. Corey Borgeson, Golden Valley Electric president and CEO, thinks they can get the power for $56 per megawatt hour, about 40% lower than the utility's average cost of power now.
It's not cheap, but we think with the benefits of the wind and the reasonable cost that Siri is providing us, it makes economic sense to take a real good hard look at this.
Ethan Shutt of Siri thinks the talks are a good sign for independent renewable energy producers in Alaska, but he says they're still fighting an uphill battle. For example, Alaska doesn't have renewable energy targets that power companies have to meet.
Basically, all we have to offer that can attract the utilities is the stability of the price and the ultimate price of the delivered power. There's no other leverage in our system here.
There's also the matter of sending power all the way to Fairbanks. Because it moves through other power companies' territory, it costs more. That's another sticky issue they're trying to resolve. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the city of Homer asks the Navy to revise their training plans.
Everything used in the exercises is actually the same weapons that are used in war. So these are real bombs, real missiles.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
In the fallout from the state's primary elections, seven incumbents have lost their seats. How this will change the course of the next session has yet to be seen. Alaska Public Media's Ellen Lockyer reports on one new contender in the Matsu Valley.
It's a breezy afternoon on the main street of Palmer in the heart of the Matanuska Valley. Wasilla City Councilman David Wilson is heading to a Municipal League meeting, but takes time to answer a few questions about his winning bid for the Senate D seat vacated by Charlie Huggins.
It's just an overwhelming feeling. It's still sinking in right now.
Wilson does not have an opponent in the general election. Wilson did what the pundits said was not possible. Running on a shoestring budget and with little or no help from the Republican Party of Alaska, Wilson beat a longtime Republican incumbent in this week's primary election. How?
Door knocking, phone calling, and I think that they really just wanted a different type of individual to serve. I think they wanted a little bit something different than the status quo of what they've been having in recent years.
The Republican Party did not back Wilson financially, nor did it assist his campaign.
Most folks were nice, but there wasn't a lot of, here, let me come and help you with this, let me come door knock with you, let me go put signs up with you. But for most part, for the sort of the old guard of, like I say, a couple individuals, they were less helpful.
And it is the old guard that may be most taken aback by Wilson's win. They expected Huggins' powerful presence in the Senate to be filled by Lynn Gaddis, who has a similar adherence to Republican values regarding fiscal and social issues. Wilson describes himself as a conservative and is backed by the ultra-conservative Republican Assembly, which also endorsed Representative Laura Reinbold. That could set him apart in Juneau, says political consultant Mark Hellenthal.
I think he was successful beating Gaddis because he went door to door and, in a sense, earned the respects of the individual voters one by one. And Gaddis didn't, and that was enough in a small turnout to get him elected. Now when he's in Juneau, he's going to have to earn the respect of his colleagues to become respected and to get a position of power.
Wilson, on the other hand, says he is motivated by a need to help others and is a proponent of strong family values. Wilson says he came to public service through volunteer work at several organizations. He now directs a nonprofit that helps domestic violence victims. He says he's confident that he can do things differently in Juneau.
Obviously, I didn't go out and raise the $50,000, $100,000, which many people said I had to raise to be a successful candidate, nor did I have an army of campaign staff or major endorsements from a lot of big entities.
He ran his campaign on about $13,000, most of it his own money. Wilson is 35 years old, has degrees in psychology, education, and business, and will become the first African American from the Matsu Valley in the legislature. In other Valley upsets, House 10 incumbent Wes Keller was ousted by newcomer David Eastman, while challenger George Rauscher defeated House 9 incumbent Jim Culver. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Kodiak's rocket launch facility will soon be active again. This comes about 2 years after a launch failure damaged buildings on the complex. On Saturday, Kodiak residents were invited to a launch complex rededication ceremony. KMXT's Kayla DeRoche was there.
AAC representatives and community leaders cut a red ribbon set up in front of the podium. The rededication ceremony is in the integrated processing facility where rocket motors are checked and tested. AAC President and Chief Executive Officer Craig Campbell says the integrated processing facility and the launch service structure are almost entirely new. He says he's proud of the construction and the facility is already attracting interest.
In the year that we were rebuilding, we also have three customers that have now indicated clear intentions of launching from Alaska. That's the best we've ever had. We've never had three diversified customers at one time want to launch in this facility. And most of them are private sector.
One of those customers is an entrepreneurial company called Vector Space Systems, which Campbell says will work to launch small satellites from the facility either later this year or early next year. Kodiak is a prime spot for satellite launches, according to Bob McCoy, the AAC board chairman. He says the location is one of two options in the United States for launching satellites into polar orbit. The other is at the Vandenberg Air Force Base.
But this facility is smaller and less complex and much more agile. It's easier to get in here at launch. It's a smaller team. There's less bureaucracy and less red tape. And it's much lower cost to launch a small satellite from this facility.
Many attendees at the event express positivity about the facility, like Sarah Rains.
I think it looks really nice. It's nice and new. We just walked outside, and it's pretty impressive to see what's been rebuilt. And it sounds like there's an exciting agenda going forward, so it's fun to hear about.
Other people have an eye on the natural resources around the facility and are concerned about access to those. Richard McIntosh says in 2005, a number of community members signed a petition supporting continued public access to Fossil Beach in the Narrow Cape area.
AADC has done a good job to date in allowing public access and just putting small perimeter fences around their facilities. And we are hoping that the people of Kodiak are hoping that they continue to do that as activities expand out here. We want, if that happens, we want more small perimeter fences rather than any sort of wholesale closing of lands out here.
Campbell says AAC will ensure that access to Fossil Beach remains open.
When we laid out the layout for Missile Defense Agency, we actually positioned the structure, the pads we're going to put in, so that they would not impact Fossil Beach. Now, we will have to close Fossil Beach and the road for an actual launch because we have to have 2 miles around the launch area kind of closed out in case something happens like happened 2 years ago. But that's very temporary. It's not that often, and we'll give plenty of advance notice.
Campbell also says the facility will make various contributions to the community, like providing local jobs and giving tours to young students, therefore encouraging an interest in science. I'm Kayla DeRoche.
The Homer City Council has passed a resolution requesting changes to U.S. Navy training exercises in the Gulf of Alaska. KBBI's Shayla Farzan has the story.
If you head out into the Gulf of Alaska with an underwater hydrophone, you may hear some of this. But next year, parts of the Gulf might sound more like this. That's because the U.S. Navy is planning to conduct its annual training exercises again there next summer. The proposed training area is 24 nautical miles from the Kenai Peninsula shoreline, just south of Prince William Sound and east of Kodiak Island. It covers over 59,000 square miles, an area slightly larger than the state of Georgia.
These trainings are aimed at maintaining military readiness. Everything used in the exercises is actually the same weapons that are used in war. So these are real bombs, real missiles, torpedoes, heavy deck guns, and then, of course, the active sonar.
That's Emily Stolarczyk. She's the program manager for the EAC Preservation Council, a nonprofit group based in Cordova. Stolarczyk spoke at Homer City Council on Monday in support of a resolution requesting changes to the proposed training.
We certainly can't understate the need for national security, but we could go about it in a more sensitive way, sensitive to the people that live here, the communities, our industries, and then wildlife as well.
Homer City Council member David Lewis sponsored the resolution. He says he's concerned about the impact of Navy training on wildlife.
It matters because all that comes in to Ketchumak Bay basically comes from the Gulf.
The proposed training would begin in May 2017, but the resolution requests the Navy wait until mid-September to avoid impacts on migrating marine species. Bob Shavelson, executive director of Cook Inlet Keeper, says the environmental impacts of naval training could be lessened by scheduling it later in the fall.
These are migration corridors for our salmon and our halibut and our whales, and we could reduce those impacts considerably if we change it to later in the year and we push it further from the coast.
But Navy Representative Alex Stone says the longer days and calmer waters in the summertime allow them to do more training exercises.
We get more value for our investment if we can plan the exercise when it has a greater probability of better weather, better conditions for flying and for training.
The resolution also requests the Navy avoid using live ordnance and sonar in marine protected areas. One concern is that these activities produce loud underwater sounds, which can physically harm marine mammals and alter their behavior. Professor John Hildebrand of the Scripps Institution of Oceanography says that beaked whales appear to be particularly sensitive to sonar.
There was an exercise in the Bahamas in about 2000, where the Navy was conducting an exercise in a relatively confined space along a channel, and then you could see beaked whales strand themselves along the channel pretty much in lockstep with the position of the sonars.
Although the effect of sonar on larger whales isn't well known, many of these species are endangered. Any activities that could harm them receive an extra level of scrutiny, says Hildebrand.
We're worried about these animals already, so we have kind of an extra layer of concern because they're already endangered, and now here's another thing that could potentially impact them, even though we don't know the details of how it might.
Currently, the Navy visually monitors the area around vessels to look for marine mammals. Again, Navy Representative Alex Stone.
Sonar could cause impacts to marine mammals if they're close to the sonar source.
Close, in this case, is 1,000 yards. That's according to the Navy's environmental impact statement.
We have a safety zone around that area, so we observe that area, and if there are marine mammals in that area, we'll power down the sonar or turn it off.
The resolution requesting changes to Navy training was unanimously approved by members of Homer City Council. It will now be sent to Alaska Senators Murkowski and Sullivan, as well as Representative Don Young. The 30-day public comment period ends August 29. In Homer, I'm Shayla Farzan.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future that delivers oil today and sustains operations for tomorrow.
If you've earned some college credits but haven't yet completed your degree, finish it now, online from anywhere. Online learning at University of Alaska Southeast provides courses in a format that is flexible for students working and raising families. Admission deadlines have been extended to August 19th. Apply now. Go to finishcollege.alaska.edu for more information. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
One of the strongest El Niños on record ended in May. A strong La Niña would normally follow, but that isn't a sure bet this time around. Brian Brettschneider is a climatologist in Anchorage who closely tracks Alaska climate data and trends. Alaska's Energy Desk is checking in with him regularly as part of a new segment, Ask a Climatologist. Brett Schneider says both El Nino and La Nina can have a significant impact on winter temperatures in Alaska, but if this La Nina materializes, it may be a different story.
Well, we've just come out of one of the strongest El Ninos on record, and that's officially been declared over. And that's reflected by sea surface temperatures in the central tropical Pacific. Those are now below normal. If they stay below normal for an extended period of time, we would then call that La Nina. There's currently a 60% chance, is the latest forecast, that we would enter into an official La Nina.
And what does it mean to be in a La Nina for Alaska?
Well, if there's a strong La Nina, Alaska typically experiences cooler temperatures, cooler with respect to normal. If there's a weak La Nina, that relationship is much less pronounced. If it is a weak La Nina, we might expect cooler temperatures, but there's so much warmth stored in the North Pacific Ocean, it's going to be really hard to dissipate that warmth. So I would expect, I would be surprised if we had a significantly colder than normal winter.
So yeah, I mean, what would your guess be?
Well, my guess, I'll defer to official guesses, and those official guesses call for a warmer than normal winter, perhaps not record-breaking warm, but certainly warmer than we would expect, looking at the previous 30 years.
So some snow?
Well, snow is a different beast entirely. The precipitation patterns are much less correlated to the ocean state, so it can be real hit or miss. You know, last winter, as little snow as there was, it was actually quite a wet winter, and there was avalanches and fatalities and you know, record snow in some spots up in the mountains, but not so much down at sea level.
Brian Brett Schneider is a climatologist who lives in Anchorage. He spoke with Annie Feit from Alaska's Energy Desk as part of a regular look at climate change in the state. If you have a question for Brian, email akenergydesk@alaskapublic.org. 1 year ago, on August 18, 2015, massive rainfall generated more than 40 landslides on Baranof and Chichagof Islands. And in Sitka, one of those landslides swept through a subdivision under construction. The slide occurred at 9:30 in the morning, demolishing one home and taking the lives of two painters, Elmer and Ulysses Diaz, working inside. A third individual, William Stortz, was Sitka's building official. He was inspecting drainage outside nearby when the slide caught him, too. Joel Curtis is a National Weather Service meteorologist who was in Sitka last August to train Coast Guard pilots. Following the slide, he became the incident meteorologist for the duration of the recovery effort. Curtis spoke with KCAW's Robert Woolsey about returning 1 year later to the scene of one of the major events of his professional life.
So I had my shoes and I had my raincoat on, and I just said, you know, hey, what the heck, I'm going to hike up there a little bit. And I was stunned at how the stratigraphy of the debris has changed since the initial slide. How much the debris has settled. I'll just give you an example. I remember standing at, there was a gravel berm at the base of the slide at Kramer Avenue, and I could look out into the debris, and there would be like these flat areas where you could just see mud. This was just after the slide, and when we were still very, very worried that it would still move. And I remember taking a rock and throwing out there, and it would go plop, a big old plop, you know. And, you know, mud would fly as you did that. And then yesterday I saw one little place in the stream where there was debris like that. And I said, well, okay, I'll make a test. And I threw a same size rock out on the thing, and the thing goes thud. Now, what a difference in the stratigraphy. That stuff has really, really settled. And so have all the small cobbles and rocks and boulders. They've also settled, and they're now embedded in that stuff. And I felt perfectly safe hiking on that. Now, I don't know if that's really safe, and somebody might tell me, no, Joel, you're wrong. Maybe that's an unsafe area. But even with the rain that we had just had, I felt very, very safe hiking on it.
It wasn't just my imagination, but after the August 18th rainfall and landslide events in Sitka, the Weather Service did start dropping in more advisories about mudslides and things. Didn't that increase slightly?
Yeah, it did. And I tell you, it was on our mind for a couple of reasons. Number one, we had saturated soils here. And any time that you get really super saturated soils, you know, it's got to be in the back of your mind. And of course, you know, we had that tragic event happen here. So we were probably a little bit snake bit. That just happens in human psychology. You know, the guys are looking at it harder and going like, God, man, I sure don't want to miss that. And so they err on the side of caution and they started mentioning it. And I think about a month afterward, we all had a collective feeling like, you know, hey, that's, you know, really not a good call that we can make. And we adjusted ourselves and started thinking that, you know, hey, we mentioned that just a few many times, too many times, and that we'll get out of that business and save that as sort of like the silver bullet. In other words, you know, gosh, you know, we really have the super saturated soils and we really have a huge amount of rain coming and we have some really strong winds with a wind shift. You know, those are the only things that the Weather Service can really add to the puzzle of mudslides and landslides.
Joel Curtis is the warning coordination meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Juneau. He served as the incident meteorologist in the aftermath of the August 18, 2015 landslide in Sitka and spoke with Robert Woolsey of KCAW. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Davis Hovey in Nome, Elizabeth Harbaugh and Annie Fite in Anchorage, Ellen Lockyer in the Matsu Valley, Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak, Shayla Farzan in Homer, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbaalaska.com. Boating accidents happen even to experienced boaters and even on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make your friends and loved ones promise to always wear a life jacket and carry emergency communication and distress signaling devices. Visit pledgetolive.org where you can file a float plan, get marine weather forecasts, and download a pre-departure checklist. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Earn a Master of Public Administration from the University of Alaska Southeast online on your schedule while having the structure of the classroom and the accessibility of e-learning. More at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.